Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend part of your evening with me. I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving, if that's a holiday that you celebrate. We have a great show for you tonight. Our topics will include Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Is he Egypt's savior and regional peacemaker, or is he a power-hungry dictator? Also, what does the resignation of Israel's Ehud Barak mean for labor and moderate peacemaking voices in that country? We'll talk more about Benghazi. It seems the Republican attempt at manufactured outrage is failing. Then we're going to go over the fiscal cliff, or are GOP legislators throwing Grover Norquist under the bus? If at any time you'd like to call in and talk with us, the call-in number for the show is 917-889-3891. But first we turn to Benghazi, where Republican attempt at manufactured outrage is failing. A CNN poll released today shows that only 40% of the public believe the administration may have misled the public in any way regarding Benghazi, while 54% say that the administration was only communicating the information that it had at the time. I think those 40% that believe there is any issue at all were born yesterday. Benghazi bears no resemblance at all to past situations where there was a presidential cover-up. There is 100% cooperation from President Obama and the rest of the executive branch with congressional investigations that are going on. There is no assertion of executive privilege by anyone. To those 40%, you know, governments do get things wrong sometimes. Communication between agencies and branches gets confused. People make assumptions. Speaking of assumptions, the day that the Benghazi consulate was attacked, six other Middle Eastern countries had mass protests by people who were angry at the anti-Muslim video posted to YouTube. It's not a stretch to think, gee, the same thing is what prompted the goings-on in Benghazi. Now, that's an easy mistake to understand. It's much easier to understand than, let's say, invading a country for having weapons of mass destruction only 2 weeks after UN weapons inspectors, who inspected all the suspected sites, issued reports saying there were no weapons of mass destruction there. 4,487 American soldiers died in a war that was fought under false pretenses. That's nearly 748 times the amount of Americans that died in Benghazi. An estimated 1,554 American civilian contractors died in Iraq. That's 254 times the amount of American civilians that died in Benghazi. Did the Republicans, now complaining about Benghazi, want to impeach George W. Bush over Iraq? No. Speaking of George W. Bush, his government and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice had more than half a dozen warnings before the September 11, 2001 attacks that al-Qaeda was trying to attack the U.S., including a CIA brief that suggested that al-Qaeda was trying to use airplanes as weapons. Approximately 2,500 Americans died in the 9/11 attacks. That is 624 times the amount of American civilians that died in Benghazi. Did the Republicans now complaining about Benghazi want to impeach George W. Bush over that? No. The Obama's administration's mistaken assumptions over Benghazi in the first few days of the attack's aftermath are much easier to understand than a president who asserts he knows nothing about his entire executive branch working an arms-for-hostages scheme involving a Middle Eastern enemy to pay for weapons to an illegal coup effort in Latin America. Did the Republicans now complaining about Benghazi want to impeach Ronald Reagan over Iran-Contra? No. Speaking of Ronald Reagan, in 1983, under his watch, Terrorists attacked a military barracks in Beirut, killing 241 American servicemen, or approximately 60 times the amount of Americans killed in Benghazi. Reagan sent the Marines into a Civil War combat zone without adequate security backup, housed them in an exposed building, and allowed the U.S. military to take acts that made it seem that we were taking sides in the conflict. Again, did the Republicans, now complaining about Benghazi, and Senator John McCain was in the Senate at the time, did he or other Republicans now complaining about Benghazi want to impeach Ronald Reagan for an incident where 60 times the amount of Americans lost their lives as did in the Benghazi incident? Once again, the answer is no. So you can see the reason why people like myself and like Republican presidential nomination candidate John Huntsman and 54% of the American people say there is no there with Benghazi. The attempt by some Republicans to portray this as a serious issue for the Obama administration is partisan smearing and spinning at its worst. It reminds me of what I said shortly after the election, that Republicans as a party have stopped being Americans. The Republican Party is now their nationality, and it is to that party to whom they pay allegiance. They have forgotten what it means to be an American, or they no longer care. It's all about gaining power for their party and whatever it is they think they can use to manufacture outrage against a Democratic politician or president. That continues to be the entire game for Republicans. If you understand that, you understand the Benghazi kerfuffle. Next, turning to the Middle East and Egyptian President Morsi. Is Mohamed Morsi Egypt's savior and regional peacemaker, or is he a power-hungry dictator? Also, what does the resignation of Israel's Ehud Barak mean for labor and also for moderate peacemaking voices in that country? Let's start off with Morsi. 5 days ago, Egyptian's new president, Mohamed Morsi, on the heels of brokering a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, announced that he would be assuming new powers that essentially put him above all other branches of the Egyptian government. What are those powers exactly? Well, the announcement said first that he has the power to issue any decision or law without the judicial or legislative branches of the Egyptian government being able to review or oppose them. The statement also contained a part that refers to the Egyptian parliament specifically. Now, some background is needed here. The Egyptian parliament is separated into two houses, just like the American Congress. There's an upper house and a lower house. Now, the lower house had already been dissolved by court order over a dispute over the constitutionality of Egyptian electoral law. So with that in mind, the statement by Morsi said that no authority can dissolve the upper house of the Egyptian parliament. This was aimed right at Egypt's judicial branch because they were due to issue a verdict that would likely have dissolved the upper branch. He also granted himself the, quote, right to use all necessary and procedures and measures needed to confront a danger facing the January 25th revolution, the life of the nation, national unity, safety of the nation, or hurtling the state institutions in performing their roles, end quote. Translated into simple words, this means that Egypt's President Morsi has given himself emergency powers to do anything to anyone for any reason. In fact, this part of the statement pretty much encompasses and makes the first two that I mentioned redundant, since it is in effect absolute dictatorship. Now, Egyptians immediately took the streets to protest this new announcement. In the wake of Morsi's election just 5 months ago, the opposition parties were actually thrown into disarray and fought against each other as much as against Morsi. But these latest statements, assuming these new expanded powers, has united Egyptians' opposition against him. In fact, he didn't just unite all the members of the opposition. He united most of the world's media coverage, including Democracy Now!, Fox News, and Voice of America in the United States, Jerusalem Post and Haaretz in Israel, Egypt's Ahram.org, and also pan-Middle Eastern media like Al Monitor and Al Jazeera. Europe's Allegheny Minor and UK Guardian, Russia's RT, and RIA Novosti all have similar coverage and analysis of the event. First time I've ever seen that in my whole life. None of the normal finger-pointing is going on that normally accompanies major events in the Middle East. No accusations of meddling by the United States or Israel or their intelligence agencies. No accusations that Russia isn't doing enough or any of the typical spin. That's not happening. The reality of Mr. Morsi is, and this has been stated by multiple media sources, we should not be surprised by this latest event, as many similar events preceded it, which suggested a desire by Mr. Morsi to consolidate power in his hands, including, one, back in early August 2012, Mr. Morsi voiced objection to a provision in the Egyptian Constitution limiting presidential power. That should have been a big clue right there. Second, in mid-August, Mr. Morsi fired several high-ranking members of the Egyptian army and replaced them with figures loyal to him. That may explain why the Egyptian army is staying out of the current dispute. Now, that one may not have seemed as strange to people, since it seemed at first that the army was making problems for the transition to a civilian government. But third, Mr. Morsi has engaged in lawsuits against members of the press to whose coverage he objected. Now, this kind of harassment of the press is common in dictators who feel no obligation to retain freedom of the press. That was a big warning sign. Now, the latest events in Egypt include a meeting that President Morsi had with members of Egypt's judicial branch last night. The reports coming out of that event were that nothing substantially has changed regarding the powers that President Morsi has assumed, but that some vague and meaningless assurances were given to the judges that all commenters have dismissed as just that, meaningless. Thousands of Egyptians descended today on Tahrir Square protesting the Morsi actions in a large protest resembling those of the Arab Spring protests. A State Department spokesperson said today that Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton spoke on Monday by telephone with Egyptian Foreign Minister Mohammed Kamel Amer to, quote, register American concerns about Egypt's political situation, end quote. Clinton stressed that the U.S. wanted to, quote, see the constitutional process move forward in a way that does not overly concentrate power in one set of hands, that ensures the rule of law, checks and balances, protection of the rights of all groups in Egypt are upheld, end quote. Now, to my way of thinking, this attempt by President Morsi has a vague similarity to the President Hugo Chavez failed referendum of 2007, where he also sought to assume dictatorial powers. Now, the main difference is, in the Chavez and Venezuela case, the matter was brought to a nationwide vote of all citizens. Another difference is that the Chavez and Venezuela case was codified in 69 concrete constitutional amendments that more or less expressed the reason why the changes were desired by Chavez. There wasn't this vague reasoning brought by Morsi of needing more power for, quote, sovereignty reasons. Now, in a country, you know, if there is a need for sweeping governmental changes that cannot be made under the current system, the only proper way to go about that, in my opinion, is via plebiscite or national vote. But even there, if you're going to the entire population for a vote on an issue or multiple issues, why not have that population vote in the changes instead of voting to give a single person absolute power to make the changes? That doesn't make sense to me. I think the reason is obvious, both in the Chavez and Morsi cases. The point of the 2007 Venezuela referendum and the recent proclamations by Morsi was really to give those people dictatorial powers, not to improve anything for the people of their respective countries. I sincerely hope, that the people of Egypt are able to turn back this latest threat to a democratic Egypt, and that they're able to get the government that they deserve from all of their hard and courageous work. Now, regarding the resignation of Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak from government, Now, as recently as a year ago, I would have thought that this was a bad situation. But approximately a year ago, Ehud Barak broke away from Israel's Labor Party and formed a centrist party called Independence in a bid to keep those labor members of the Knesset, which is Israel's legislature, loyal to him and keep them members of the government coalition supporting, of all people, Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, about 13 of Labor Party's members of Knesset went along with Ehud Barak to form the Independence Party, and this allowed Netanyahu to maintain a slim 66 out of 120 Knesset member coalition, and it prevented the dissolution of the Netanyahu government. In making the split from Labor, Ehud Barak said that he was tired of infighting within Labor, as he accused the rest of the Labor Party of, quote, moving too far to the dovish end of the political spectrum, end quote. What an awful quote, huh? So rather than being a defeat for those of us who support an Israel working to create a two-state solution that affords self-determination for the Palestinians, the announcement of Ehud Barak's resignation signals a huge defeat for Netanyahu and for the ability of Israel's Likud party to remain in control of Israel. In fact, it's actually the second major setback for Netanyahu in 3 weeks, the first being the defeat of Netanyahu's overtly preferred candidate in the U.S. presidential elections, Mitt Romney. Now, Netanyahu faces an election in January, and one has to think that these two major setbacks, one right after the other, so near to the election, are the death knell for his continued control of Israel. And it is that, and with Iran policy and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, that the resignation of Ehud Barak is likely to most impact Israel and the Middle East. Now, here's something interesting. Regarding the January election, if Netanyahu and Likud were to lose the next election and its aftermath struggle to present a ruling coalition, the likely next prime minister would be the current head of the Labor Party, someone little known outside of Israel, and it's a woman, a very bright woman, Shelley Yachimovich. Yachimovich's Wikipedia bio indicates that her parents were Holocaust survivors who immigrated to Israel from Poland. She has a degree in behavioral science from Israel's Ben-Gurion University and lives in South Tel Aviv and has two children. Now, Yachimovich was a radio station journalist for several years, and according to Wikipedia, she earned a reputation as being opinionated and critical of conventional wisdom and the establishment. She has also been described as an assertive, abrasive radio host journalist with very pronounced feminist and social democratic views. That sounds vaguely familiar to me, although I can't quite put my finger on it. Here is a long but worthwhile soundbite of Israeli Labor Party leader Shelley Yachimovich from a recent visit to the U.S. to speak at the Jewish People's Policy Conference on November 6th.
Nobody deserves to be thrown to the margins of society while a small group of people get rich. Nobody. In Israel, advancing this modest dream is a huge political challenge, not only because of the dominance of the security and regional issues, but because in Israel, the definitions of left and right are very confused. Some people, like me, seek peace as well as social change, but you will also find people on the left who support peace but share a totally neoliberal approach to the economy. Meanwhile, there are people on the right who are also lower income earners. Many of them increasingly realize how badly they have been hurt by these economic policies. I'm trying to redefine and rejuvenate our political debate. This means adding a serious discussion on the economy to the public agenda in Israel. It has the potential to change the traditional two-block political landscape in Israel. It is no coincidence that over the past year, the Labour Party has enjoyed a dramatic increase in popularity in the polls. Poverty and social injustice foster racism and intolerance. This is true everywhere, not just in Israel. So, in a society with huge economic gaps and deep poverty, the flowers of peace will never bloom. My goal is to build a better society.
A better society. So, I hope you all could understand that she does have a bit of a thick accent when she speaks English, but Yachimovich is clearly a champion of peace and social justice. And regarding relationships with Iran and the Palestinians, it would clearly be a victory for negotiations and peace if Yachimovich were to replace Netanyahu and become the next prime minister of Israel. She's really an outspoken supporter of a two-state solution in all respects. Seems like someone who would pursue peace and negotiated settlement quite aggressively, both with the Palestinians and with Iran. Next, are we going over the fiscal cliff, or are GOP legislators throwing Norquist under the bus? Now, there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations going on regarding the fiscal cliff. But right now, what fascinates me more than anything is to watch Republicans in this odd dance with the pledge that they made not to raise taxes. Let's listen to what three prominent Republicans said in the last 48 hours about the tax pledge they made. First, Republican Bob Corker from Tennessee.
I'm not obligated on the pledge. I made Tennesseans aware. I was just elected that the only thing I'm honoring is the oath that I take when I serve, when I'm sworn in this January.
So he says, quite simply, that he, Representative Bob Corker from Tennessee, does not feel obligated to any pledge other than his oath of office. Now, how about Representative Eric Cantor, who is the second most powerful Republican in the House of Representatives, the Republican House Majority Leader from Virginia?
There's a lot that has been said about this pledge, and I will tell you, when I go to the constituents that have elected, reelected me, it is not about that pledge. It really is about trying to solve problems.
So Cantor is a little bit more evasive than Corker, but the meaning is really the same. He is saying his constituents are more interested in him being part of the process to find solutions rather than the tax pledge that he signed. Finally, let's hear Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina.
When you're $16 trillion in debt, the only pledge we should be making to each other is to avoid becoming Greece, but I will violate the pledge, long story short, for the good of the country, only if Democrats will do entitlement reform.
Graham's statement, I think, is one of the more interesting ones. So he is afraid of the United States, in his words, becoming Greece. But he's only interested in violating his pledge to raise taxes to avoid that scenario if he gets something in return. That doesn't seem particularly patriotic to me. So Grover Norquist then started doing the talk show rounds, and when asked about what the several Republican legislators talking about going back on their pledge, he had this to say.
No pledge taker has voted for a tax increase. They've had some people discussing impure thoughts on national television.
Well, now we know. So becoming an elected Republican official amounts to joining a big love-style polygamous marriage with all other Republican elected officials and Grover Norquist, with Norquist playing the patriarchal Bill Paxton figure. I guess in that scenario, John Boehner would be Jennifer Goodwin, Mitch McConnell would be Gene Triplehorn, and Eric Cantor would be Chloe Sevigny. What has to be an ominous, thinly veiled threat to Republican elected officials, though, is what Norquist said later in the same clip.
We would certainly highlight who has kept their commitment and who hasn't.
In case anyone hearing that has any doubt, that means one thing. Anyone who violates the pledge is going to find that Norquist's organization and similar ones are going to fund Republican primary opponents against them. To a Republican candidate, I assure you that is no joking matter. What I think this entire fiscal cliff situation is going to come down to is this strange game of, Norquist started down this line, so I might as well go there. It's going to come down to whether enough Republican congressmen are willing to commit adultery on Grover Norquist. If they don't, we're going to fall over the cliff. That's before we talk about having any agreement on the Democratic side regarding entitlement reform. And quite frankly, I would rather fall over the cliff than cut Social Security or Medicare from poor or middle-class people. But if we don't have enough Republicans to pass a tax hike in the House, nothing else matters. We're probably going over the cliff. And a final note by Norquist in one of the talk shows may be a foreshadowing of what is to come. Apparently, since Grover Norquist has been having Republican politicians sign the pledge not to raise taxes, no Republican congressman or senator has ever signed the Norquist pledge and then gone back on it and voted to raise taxes or to create new ones. With that track record, I would bet on either going over the cliff or that we would get the same bargain we got last time where the Bush tax cuts were extended and no other changes were made. Speaking of the fiscal cliff and deficits, there was an article in the Huffington Post co-written by Christina Wilkie and Ryan Grimm that really got me going. It tells a story of a group of CEOs who got together and decided to offer advice on how to cut the debt. Working with the Peter Peterson PAC-backed Center for a Responsible Federal Budget, these CEOs, who are worth eight figures and up, many of whom represent companies that have reaped billions from government bailouts, government contracts, and tax breaks, are demanding cuts for programs for the poor and middle class to pay down the deficit instead of tax increases for the wealthy and corporations. The article in the Huffington Post is called CEO Council Demands Cut to Poor and Elderly While Reaping Billions in Government Contracts and Tax Breaks. Now, I am not going to name names. You can read the Huffington Post article. A link to it is on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. But just three of the companies represented by these CEOs raked in $28 billion in government contracts last year. And another company received a $10 billion government bailout during the recent fiscal crisis. These CEOs suggesting cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and other entitlements while allowing a tax break. These CEOs are suggesting cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and other entitlements while they are demanding a tax break for the income that these companies make overseas. And this tax break that they're demanding would net their companies a combined $250 billion. That's $250 billion with a T. There are videos from some of these aforementioned folks that you don't want to miss for the audacity of their hypocrisy. So you don't want to forget to go to my blog to check it out again at stevelaser.blogspot.com. What's amazing to me is that these CEOs just don't get it. These are supposed to be smart men and women, but they just don't get it. They're so out of touch with what's experienced in the everyday lives of real, typical Americans that they don't understand how bad this looks. You know, there are people, lots of people, who can't pay for their health care, and they're looking at having to eat cat food after they retire, and these CEOs want benefits cut for poor and middle-class Americans so their companies can get tax benefits from doing business overseas. I mean, these CEOs couldn't do more damage to their efforts they are championing if they tried. I mean, this is disgusting. What these CEOs are doing and saying is disgusting, and I don't want to even talk about it anymore. These folks should just be ashamed of themselves. So we're going to move it up a little bit. We're going to close today's show with an odd fact from the last election. An exit poll conducted by the Pew Forum found that Mitt Romney did worse than George W. Bush did with Mormon voters. That's right. The very first ever Mormon candidate for president did worse than the previous candidate for his party among that same demographic. In 2004, 80% of Mormons voted for Bush, while 19% supported John Kerry. According to the exit polls conducted by the Pew Forum, only 78% of Mormons voted for Mitt Romney, and 21% of Mormons voted for Barack Obama. I mean, that's astounding. That would be like Obama doing worse than Dukakis with the black vote. Now, while that is shocking, it goes along with another incredible statistic. The ticket of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan owned houses in five states. They lost every single one of those five states. Paul Ryan owns a home in the state he represents, Wisconsin, of course, and the ticket lost that state. And Mitt Romney owns houses in Massachusetts, California, New Hampshire, and Michigan. Barack Obama won all of those states. It seems like the more a group of folks knows either one of them, the less likely they wanted to vote for him. Well, that's all I have for this evening. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 8 p.m. Eastern Time this Thursday, November 29th. Until then, have a great evening and a great rest of your week.